I'm a goddess. Yeah. I had nothing to do with that. But let me explain that. My name is Denise, and my name in Greek means wine goddess. So there you go. That was a parent and God thing. But when I found out I was with my name, I realized that I have a double whammy of ego, because first of all, I'm an alcoholic, and then when I found out I was a goddess, I have the ego itself again. So I've got a double whammy, and that's why I'm standing here. But I wanted to thank Karen for asking me to be a speaker today, because it's part of what I have to do to stay sober today, and I learned that from you all. And it's an exciting day. Did anybody see the sunrise this morning? Mm-hmm. Wasn't that beautiful? You know, there's a lot of sunrises I didn't get to see, or if they were the sun was rising, I wasn't sure if the sun was setting or if it was rising, because my drinking took me there. And today, I'm part of this being up here as a speaker, and at the Howe Place, and it's a big day at the Howe Place. We you know, the Breakfast Club, we have the breakfast, and well, I'm speaking, but I would have been part of it anyway, because I would have been in listening, because I like to be part of. That's part of my disease. And later on today, well, right after this meeting, we have another one, and there's another one. And this evening, there's a barbecue. There's another group that's going to be celebrating, I don't know how many years, and they're going to have a barbecue, and they're going to have another speaker tonight. We have apparently he's a circuit speaker. And I'll bet you he's not a goddess, though. I know he's not a goddess. I will be here to see if he's a goddess and see if he talks like a goddess. We'll see how much ego he has. But I wanted to thank Karen, too, because of the fellowship of being part of. My alcoholism took me to points where all I did was isolate, and I'm that kind of a drinker. When let me back up just a tad. Not only am I a goddess, but I am just started, and I am into the fourth step. Ooh, yeah, there we go. I'm in the columns. I've got this column, and I'm doing this, and I've got this person, I've got that, da, 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 da. I'm in the columns, and Karen's in the column now, because she's caused me stress to be up here and to be a speaker, and so I'm freaking out about that. So she's on the list. She is on the list. So, but before I can get into the fourth step and work on the fourth step, I had to start with the first. But I'm told that before I do anything, I have to stand here and I have to justify and I have to qualify why I'm up here. And I think I just did. But my name is Denise, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date, I have a sobriety date, July 9, 2009. I have a home group, which is the Way Group over at Hillside Church. And I'm supposed to tell you that it's the best group in all of AA. Yes, come on over and see us. The Breakfast Club is my home group away from home group, as is the Brown Baggers, because when those groups in particular have been so, I'm lucky to be able to come to these meetings because they have helped me so much to stay sober, and what everybody talks about and listening. I like coming to meetings. I don't share a whole lot, but I watch and I listen. I sit at the Brown, the Breakfast Club. I come in and I usually sit way back there, but only because usually there is a speaker, or the head of the meeting is where Roma is. And I was told, when you come to a meeting, you get in the middle. You get in the middle. Go. You get up front. Meeting makers make it. That's what I was told. And so I sit and I listen and I watch you guys. I watch you. And I have to think of that movie where the Breakfast Club, where the janitor comes in and he says, you may think I don't know what's going on, but I am the eyes and ears of this institution, you know. And actually that clock behind there is wrong. So anyway, that was So that's how I have to qualify myself. And I'm supposed to, I've been through the 12 steps before. And this time around, I'll get into that a little later, but they talk about, I wanted to back up just a tad too, with the fellowship. If it wasn't for this fellowship, when I first got sober, I didn't know how to, I had relationship problems. And they talk about the, on page 52, they talk about the bedevilments. And they say, we had trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional nature. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness, and we were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to make a go of real help to other people. That was me to a T. And the fellowship it's important for me because I was such the isolator in all these bedevilments that I had. The first time, I was probably about 2 weeks sober, and I was told, make the round, go to different meetings and whatnot. And I remember walking in here, there was a Saturday night speaker, and I remember walking in here, the place was packed, absolutely packed. I don't know who the speaker was, but it was just packed. I remember we had to pull in chairs from the other room, and I remember walking in here, and I thought, I am home. Oh my God, all these people are alcoholics and they understand me. I could come into a speaker meeting, or I could pull anybody aside at this meeting if I had to and say, I'm having trouble right now. Can you help me? And I know anybody, I could have picked anybody, and they would have said, yes, I can help you. That, what a feeling that was of being among people that understand me. And when you come from, like in my house, my husband is not an alcoholic, and thank God, but he's got other issues, and I'll get into those in a minute. I have to get into those issues, but he doesn't understand like you guys do, you know. And another thing too, and this is when I knew I was in the right place. I was probably a week sober. I had just found the How place. And anybody that's had to find the How place, that's a story in itself, you know. You know, I did the whole thing. I stopped at the fire station, and I remember walking in, and I said, I'm trying to find the How place. And they just started laughing. They go, yep, right behind us. And I was like, oh, thanks. And I said, you got another one off the street, you know. I'm going in for recovery. and I don't know who it was. One of the firemen, he goes, good luck to you, truly. And I was like, whoa. So I find the How place. And I walk into the meeting, and there was a guy. I don't know who he was, and I don't know if I've ever seen him since, but I was relating. And this guy was speaking, and he was sharing, and he goes, yeah, you know what it's like, and you're when you wake up the next morning, and you go to brush your teeth, and you gag because you've got that gag reflex. And I said, oh, man, this is home. I am home. People understand that. I thought I was the only one in the world that was gag and then puke after I figured out what time it was. You know, if I was sober enough to even try to brush my teeth, you know, that type of thing. It was just the craziness of that. And I knew I was home. And I know today, too, I can come to here or any place, my home group, the Brown Baggers, the Breakfast Club, the Soberettes, any of these groups. I can come to the Night Owls and walk in and say, hey, can somebody help me? And I know somebody will be here. I'll back up just a tad, too. My parents, I was born and raised in Bristol, Connecticut, which is the home today of ESPN. And I remember it when I was, it was an airfield. And and we used to go there when we were kids, and they had a restaurant, and we would all the families in Bristol, a lot of times, especially in the summer, and we'd go. And they also had this thing where it was a training facility for firemen. And so we would watch them, we'd watch the planes land and take off, you know, they had training, so every now and then we'd get to see the firefighters train. And so that was cool. And there's and something's going on in Bristol right now with some football player. And the interesting thing about that is I happen to know his father. I forgot the name now, but anyway, I'm not a big sports fan, but anyway, my parents are not alcoholics. My dad is not an alcoholic. My mother, this is what I've been told in the program, she is not here to defend herself, but my mother had alcoholic tendencies. She, I believe through being in the program that she was probably a binger. My mother could really toss one off if for a day or two or whatever and not touch alcohol again for 6 months to a year. And my dad was that type where he could nurse a white Russian for a year. You know, he was just that type. So, but then I find out when I got sober that her dad, my maternal grandfather, was, I'm not going to call him an alcoholic because he's not here to defend himself either. He was a heavy drinker, and apparently he was abusive. And I was told that there was numerous times he would get violent. And he died when I was younger, so I'm kind of glad I didn't have to see that. Although I do, you know, I wonder if he knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's just things you think about when you're in the program. I am the middle kid, so not only am I a goddess, I'm the middle child, I'm the first daughter. I have an older brother, Mike, and I have a younger sister, Lisa, and we all grew up, my parents both worked in the shops. My mother, she retired from General Electric, and my dad, he retired from Marlin Rockwell. And funny little story, Damon, I'm kind of into the archives, and Damon and I were talking a little bit about, long story short, but there's a little connection between Marlon Rockwell and the, I think it was Roland Hazard, but anyway. One thing my parents did, we never had a lot of money. One thing my parents did, though, they bought a camper, a pop-up camper. And that was just, that was the coolest thing for me because when I was, I would get so excited because we're going camping. And my grandparents lived in Caribou, Maine. So when the shops would, they would shut down for 2 weeks in the summer and we would pack up the camper and we'd head out up to upstate New York. You know, that's all Yankee land, by the way. That's all Yankee stuff. Connecticut, I'm a Southern New Englander. I'm not a Yankee. So we would go up to upstate New York and into Quebec, Canada, and down and through Maine and all that. And so that was our summer. And I loved it because I had responsibilities because I had to do stuff. And I found in my pattern, give me something to do. Give me something to do, and I'll get it done. That was, and so I enjoyed camping a lot. I liked being outside and anything to do with also making fires. I was really good at making the fires for our marshmallows and stuff like that. And my parents would always say to me, Denise, it's time to go get the, make our sticks. And I would go through the tearing ass through the woods getting everybody's sticks. I mean, I had enough sticks for the whole campground. So that was that nervous energy, I guess, but I loved it. So anyway, so the camping saved my life. And how my parents ever came up with that money to pay for that little thing was that's a God thing because they said that's gonna save Denise's ass one of these days. So and that's about I can't complain about my childhood. My parents did the best they could with what they had, and we never went without. And I come from a pretty big French family, so everybody took care of themselves. You know, everybody would help take care of. And everybody lived in Bristol. And today, nobody lives there anymore. But, you know, we just scattered. And that happened really because of the jobs. They were disappearing. The manufacturing died, and so did a lot of that. And everybody dispersed. So we get into, I will tell you, though, the first resentment, because I'm in the fourth step, remember. Write this down, Karen. My first resentment is for the I wanted to be an altar boy. because I could go to the church, and I loved being in the church. I'm just one of those. I liked being in the church, and I would watch the priests and do all this stuff and whatnot, and I would watch these altar boys, and they would just be stupid. You know, they didn't know what to do. They couldn't do it like I could. And I went up to Father McNerney and I said, "Father, I would like to be an altar boy." And he goes, "Well, Denise," he goes, "you can't because you're a girl." Yeah. Ooh. So not only was there's a feminism starting there, and then there you go. But it was that, but I remember, it wasn't even that though. I remember that shot. It was like, I can't do something because I'm a girl. Oh. And now today, thank God, they have altar servers, and girls get to do it now. I like to say I had a hand in that because of all that praying. So that was my first resentment. But I loved the church. I did. And along with that, so since I couldn't be an altar boy, then I was going to be a nun. I was going to be a nun. And I remember going home saying, because nuns could sing, and they had beautiful voices. And that was to me was, you're close to God because of the voices. And when the choir was in and all, oh. And I still think of that today, and I was like, yeah. So I remember running home, and I was like, I want to be a nun. And they're like, no, you don't. So it was the first thing, too, write that down to my parents. It was like I couldn't do it because I was, I'm like, why not? You know, it's great. And of course, there was the expectations. Well, because you're going to get older, you're going to get married and have kids and all that. Kids? Mm-mm. When we were growing up, there was a great aunt, and she asked us three kids. They asked Mike, they said, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? And Mike said, oh, I want to be a fireman. And Mike was a volunteer firefighter. And Lisa, she's a few years younger than me, and what Lisa, they said, what do you want to be? She goes, I want to be a mommy. And I'm like, oh, really? So they asked me, Denise, what do you want to be? And of course, I could have said goddess, but I said I wanted to be Mick Jagger because I wanted just to be out there. I wanted to be alive, and they were all like, something's wrong with this chick. So. So you just picture, and I've got a mic on too. I can actually show you my Mick Jagger moves, but I won't do that. We'll spare you. So anyway, so you can see, as a little kid, I started with a lot of resentments. One thing I could do when I was a kid, though, a lot of the kids had resentment because of me, because I could run, and I found the. I was quick, and somebody said the other day too, I still walk fast. But I would run. I would run everywhere. My mother smoked at the time, and she'd say, because it was responsibility, Denise, go up to the Superette and get me a pack of cigarettes. That, back then, you could do this. Mm-hmm. And so I would, and I would run. And I'd run all the way to the Superette, and I'd run home in record time. And my mom was real happy because she had her cigarettes. Whereas if she asked my brother or Lisa, or actually my brother, because my sister had to tag along with me because she was too young. So, but if she asked Mike, Mike would just dilly-dally, and she wouldn't get her cigarettes for about a week, so he'd probably smoke them, so. But anyway, that's how my childhood was, and I can't complain. It was pretty cool. We get into grade school, and I'm watching a pattern here. I'm getting into grade school, and I was really good at sports, and I was popular and all that stuff. And then all of a sudden, here comes high school. And we had all the different grade schools were coming into high schools now, and there was two high schools. And so there's lots of kids in these high schools. And I realized that I'm not the best runner anymore. I'm not the best baseball player. I'm not the best at anything. I'm good enough, or I'm okay. And there was that thing of like, uh-oh, where do I fit in? Where do I fit in? And, you know, they talk about that in the book, and of all these, and then all of a sudden, that the 100 forms of fear that they talk about in the book, and this was starting in high school. So, anyway, and I was a good student and whatnot, but I remember thinking, well, I needed to belong somewhere. So I went with, so I started hanging out with the wrong crowd. Well, they weren't the wrong crowd, really, but they were just the pot smokers. You know, they were the, they smoked cigarettes, and they smoked some pot, you know, they did some stuff. So I started getting into kind of that crowd. And let me just spend about a second or two on my drug use. And that's about it. I did the classic, I smoked some pot, and I did some, I did drop some acid a few times. But then there were two speakers I just heard recently, and I loved them because they told my story. When I was in high school, to fit in, I would, you go to the keg parties and they're dropping this and whatever, taking that. And I remember they both talked about this, and they said, I would lie and tell everybody that I did it. And that was me. I would lie a lot. Oh, yeah, I dropped acid last night, too, and whatnot. Oh, yeah, it was great. I remember the first time I did a tab and whatnot, and then I didn't like it, man. I'm too much a control freak for that stuff. But I would, and so I knew I'd never wanted to do it again, but I would lie about it. Oh, yeah, I did it. And it was easier just to lie about it than to tell these people that, look, man, you guys are all nuts when you're on that stuff. Yeah, and you are out of control. I'm not going to be like that. So, and that was about the end of that deal. And that was about it. I didn't do a whole lot of drugs yet. You know, that was one of the biggest words I ever learned in AA was, you're eligible too. Just because I'm sober today of alcohol, I could easily pick up something else. And this is what the book tells me. So I get that all out of the way. And so I finally get out of high school and I go into college. And there was another thing too. I went in for graphic design, and about this, and this time it was all freehand. You had to do a lot of this stuff all freehand. Computers really weren't inundated yet into the school. And so they're kind of trying to incorporate that, and I was kind of far along. And then somebody had said, well, you're going to have to go back and take these courses in order to be a graphic designer. And I was thinking, oh, man, you know, I've been through all these years of school. I just want to get this done. So blah, blah, blah. There's another turning point in my life. It was like, oh, you got to be kidding me. Instead of just, like, taking it, I decided to get my bags, and I went across the street, and I went into a bar. This is about 12 o'clock in the afternoon, and I had a beer. And I thought about it, and I was like, well, I'm not doing this again, okay? It's because I didn't want to keep going, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I was told recently, too, it's all part of the God's plan. They talk about, I was talking with my sponsor a few days ago, and we were talking about how wouldn't it have been so cool when we were kids or growing up and you had that one adult that you could totally, totally trust and tell them anything, you know, and kind of steer you in the right direction. Because I know I wasn't getting that from my parents. It's the cool pattern of actually going through step four, because you dig up this stuff up and it's like, wow, it's painful, but it's so cool. But anyway, I rocked on like that for a while, and then there was a thing that happened. I was the guy I was going out with. It was a very abusive relationship, and finally I ended it. So the girls, they said, "Well, let's go bar hopping." Okay, yeah, just what I need to be doing is going bar hopping. So this is kind of a turning point in my life, though. So that night, we were at this bar, and this guy comes up to me, and he starts talking, and I'm thinking, oh, God, here we go. And but he insists on telling me about his rocks. And he's got, you know, he starts talking about his rocks, and I'm thinking, wow, okay. He wants to show me his rocks, and they're... You know, they're smooth, and he's got others that, you know, his rocks are really, really good, and I'm like, wow. So we start talking, and it's getting, you know, we're getting pretty interested in his rocks. And so the night is ending, and, you know, and I really wanted to see these rocks. So he starts talking, and I gave him my number, and I'm leaving with the girls, and I was like, man, geologists are so cool. Yeah. And I ended up marrying the guy. and I see all his rocks. And that's my whole yard is full of rocks because he's a geologist. That's what I was telling you. He's got problems, man. He's got problems. I'm an alcoholic, but he's a geologist. Jeez. So the two of us together, we just... But I'll tell you what, the guy's a saint for putting up with what I had to, for what he had to, what I put him through. And it's through this program that I found out. So we walk on like that. We get married, and this is a huge point for me. I got married and moved to Georgia all within like 24 hours. And when we drove down, because Tom had a job down here, and you know I'm a Southern New Englander, and I'm in Georgia. Ooh, that was huge. And I remember, and it was hot. It was in September. We're driving down. It's hot. And we hit the border, and we got out to get gas. And I remember saying to Tom, well, I'm leaning against the car, and I was like, what the hell did I get into? And Tom turns around and goes, yeah, it is hot as hell down here, isn't it? And I'm thinking, you don't have any idea, because I'm thinking, what did I do? How did I get married? How am I ended up in Georgia? And it was like the worst part. It was the worst part thing that could have happened to me. So I thought, and this is a God shot, because not only did God bring me down here to, with my alcoholism, He brought me here to get sober. And it was here that I had to get. I had a choice. I had to get sober or not. So I'm rocking on like this for quite a few years, and finally the insanity of the alcoholism starts kicking in. It was a point in time. My mother died in 2006, and about that time, a few months later, I got laid off. They were getting rid of my job, and I heard something on, I don't know if it was the radio or TV or whatever, but I heard the saying, well, it's 5 o'clock somewhere. That little saying, that was it for me, y'all. That was it. I was like, there you go. And right from that point on, I became a 24-hour drinker. And I was a blackout drinker. But I was I didn't care anymore. And I don't know where it went wrong. And then the insanity would start. I remember before everything came to the point where I all I could do was get up, sit on the couch, and whatnot. They said to me, a friend of ours said, "Let's go to Dixie Speedway." And I'm thinking, all right. Well, how am I supposed to? And I'm at this point, you know, I'm a wine goddess, so I'm a wine drinker. So, and I'm like, well, how am I going to get wine into the into Dixie Speedway? And so, but I figured it out. So I had wine, and I had a goblet. I had, you know, an acrylic goblet. Jesus. And so I'm, and it's a dirt track, if anybody doesn't know what Dixie Speedway is. So I'm standing there, and I've got a goblet, and so I go to take a drink in my wine, and there's like an inch of dirt at the bottom of my wine glass. And I'm standing there with a goblet, and I'm like, what an ass. You know, the insanity of it. And my husband was not there, but I was so we'll rock on like that. And then there was another turning point too, where the insanity of this all. My husband, he was getting sick of it. He said to me, it was around my birthday, and he said, "Come on, we're gonna go get you your birthday present." I was like, "All right, yeah." Well, at this point, I was like, "Damn it, I don't want to go because." The anxiety was so bad, and I would get into places, I would start shaking. I mean, literally, I couldn't walk. And I'm like, okay, so we get in the truck, and we go down to Home Depot. And I'm thinking, what am I going to get at Home Depot for my birthday? So I'm thinking, well, new lawn furniture, and blah, blah, blah. Well, Tom, he walks in, and he goes, And we walk over to the ride-on mowers, and he goes, which one do you want? And I was like, whoa, what? You know that silent scorn they talk about in the book? Ooh. And I'm like, what are we doing here? He goes, because, you know, I'm tired of working all week and coming home, and you're not doing anything except sitting on the couch. He goes, you're going to do something. A goddess doesn't go on a mower, on a ride-on mower. So, but of course, we ended up getting one. So I was like, I want that one. He goes, that's good choice because it's a Briggs & Stratton engine and all this stuff, whatever. So, okay. So he gets me this mower, and we go, and a couple weeks later, I know he's out of town, and I know he's coming home, and I was like, shit, I got to go get on the mower. And so I'd somehow I'm driving drunk on a mower. I'm toasted. And I've got the wine. They can add these little wine bottles, and I had one in my mower. It has like a little thing you put a cup holder. Well, I have my wine there. So I'm driving. So Tom comes home, and I'm like, hey, on the mower, like, look at me. I'm so, you know, I'm cutting the grass. Well, Tom walks over, and he's going, yeah. And he walks up. And he comes up to me, and he goes, he didn't even say hi, he was just like smiling. And he goes, and all of a sudden, I don't even know what this thing's called. And it was like a handle, and all of a sudden he lifts it up, and all of a sudden you hear, rrr. Well, I'm cutting, we have an acre of grass, and I'm cutting the grass, but I never engaged the blade. So he, so, and you know, I was tagged right then and there, and try to, and I was so happy too, because I'm like, look at the grass, it's great, and I didn't engage. So and that's where my alcoholism brought me, to this insanity, just that insanity. And it was a few weeks later, I went for the downfall. This was it, and I ended up in I had to go to the doctor's, and she took one look at me. This is just a family doctor. She took one look at me. She said, you're dying. She was so mad at me. She goes, get your ass right now up to. She goes, no. She goes, what the hell are you doing? And she goes, you get your ass up to emergency right now. And she dropped what she was doing, and she got on the phone and called emergency and said, you know, this girl's coming in. And that was the beginning of the ride. Not only am I a goddess, but I'm a whitewater kayaker. And we have a term in kayak, and it's called huck it. You're going to huck it. And I knew it right then and there. I was going to ride this out. There was this point in time, Bill W. talks about it, where he had that white light. I didn't have the white light so much, but I certainly had this feeling. And I don't know if it was being scared or not, and I don't even care at all, but it worked for me. And it said, you're on the fence, you can either go one way or the other. I never knew what an alcoholic death was, but I was ready to go for it. And there was that flash of just, of huck it, just huck it. And I remember, okay, I'll ride this out. And I did. And I was in emergency. My liver, I was jaundiced with, my eyes were yellow, my skin was yellow, liver shutting down, kidneys are shutting down. The doctors had told Tom, they said, well, you know, we just had a girl in here just a week before she was, and she didn't make it. And he said, he goes, I'm not trying to scare you, I'm just trying to prepare you. And I didn't know this till after, but, and I ended up riding it out. And it was a God thing that I was there. But I remember, I knew that I was going to be okay. There was that silent voice that, it was like that silent pat on the shoulder saying, I'm here, you're going to be okay, you're going to ride this out. Okay. And so I'm riding this out, and I get into the rooms, and there's the first place I walked into was the way group, and I don't know if there's anybody there that was there the first day I was, but I was yellow, and I remember them there the first thing, you know, hey, you know, usually when everybody walks in, hey, how you doing? People were like this, ooh, because I was that sick, man, I was that sick, and And I remember they gave me a book, and I had to go into rehab for a few days. And I remember pulling out the book, and I'll get to that later, but I remember trying to read the book. And you try reading this book or anything when you're going through the DTs, and words were jumping off the page, and I had audio. There was music playing from the ceiling fans, okay? And I've tripped before. I understand this, man. You couldn't tell me that music was not coming from the ceiling fan. I knew it was. And I'm arguing with Tom about that. Tom, can't you hear that? He's like, oh, here we go. And so we're arguing about this, and all of a sudden I happened to look, and I went over and I just stomped on something, and Tom, and he goes, what are you doing? And I said, well, there was a cockroach. Well, he went flying over there, and he goes, and he looks, and there was one, and he goes, oh, thank God, because I was, you know, he didn't know. And so the whole thing, too, was he didn't know either. He didn't know. He didn't understand anything about alcoholism. I didn't understand anything about alcoholism. And next, the only thing I knew was that I was going to ride this out. Next thing I know, I'm in AA. And they talk about I mentioned before I was home, and I was home. And I did what I was told. There's an old-timer that in my home group, and God bless him, he celebrated 50 years, and just around the holidays. And he said to me, he said, you're going to be all right. He said, you do what you're told. And he just, and a lot of you said that to me too. Just do what you're told. Listen. Go in and listen to what people, identify with what people are saying. And at first for me, that was hard because I'm thinking, well, when people are coming in and people that would drive drunk with their kids in the car. And I remember saying that to my sponsor at the time, and she goes, what would you think you'd be doing? Ooh, yeah. Right between the eyes. I would have been. I know I would have been. It was that type of thing of, I learned how to rethink and relive in these rooms, and I have to do it every day. That's all I've got is one day at a time, and I don't know how many times it's talked about in the 12 and 12 or in the big book. I've got one day at a time, and I have a daily reprieve, and that's all I've got, contingent on my spiritual maintenance. And we were talking about that just the other day, that I realized how sick I can still get in this program. And I'm coming on about six years and whatnot, and it doesn't matter. I'm just accumulating days, and that's all I'm doing, but I got to do the work. Every day I try to do something in the program. What I've done today, let me back up just a second, because something really important hit me just the other day when we were talking about this. They were talking, when I'm in trouble, or I know enough about the program now that I get this gut feeling, kind of like when I'm getting up here, and I know I got to do something, I've got to either, call my sponsor, call somebody, or come up here and talk to you all, because if I rest on my laurels, I'm a goner. Because alcohol is a subtle foe. We are heading for trouble if we do. And I know today I can't do that. And I was resting on my laurels just a few months ago, and I think I had a pretty good strong program, man. I'm starting the steps again. I got through with the traditions. I asked somebody to go help me go through the traditions. And going through the traditions, the questions that were asked were everyday life questions. Like, well, how would you put that tradition in your everyday life? Oh. And things started to pop up. So I asked her if she would go through the steps with me, and we started doing that. And things were just popping up. And it's amazing how I can stand here today and clean my heart, you know. And that's what I call the fourth step, is the cleaning of the heart. And so I can stand here and go on and on, but I really want to get to something that we were talking about. It was the spiritual experiences and how you can become spiritually bankrupt. And man, that's one of my, I've got to watch that every single day. That's why I do. I wake up every day and I wake up and I remind myself every single morning that I'm an alcoholic. I keep my alarm clock on my big book. And when I wake up and I turn it off, I know it's on that big book, and I know I'm an alcoholic. And I know I have to get to a meeting. I know I have to call my sponsor or get in touch with. I work with my sponsees, and I have to rock on like that. And it's okay today. And that was another thing too, working with people. I'm not the best at it. I'm still kind of I still got the relation. Ooh, but I want things to happen now, and it's not going to happen now. It's all in God's time. And but I've got you all to thank to help me to make sure I'm set, because I watch you all too. And there's plenty of you that I've walked up to and said, "You all right today? You all right today?" So I might not share too much in a meeting or whatnot, but I watch people, and when somebody's coming through those doors for the first time, man, we all know that. And I say a silent prayer. It's like, you can do it. Huck it. Just huck it. We can do it. You can do it. You know, I started off a little bit. We were talking about the bedevilments. And, you know, and it was pointed out to me that after the bedevilments, which are on, they're in We Agnostics. And you keep working that, and you start getting into the steps, and you go through four or five, yeah, and you belong, and you know, the meditation and whatnot, and you get to 12, and you're helping people. When you get to step 9, there's this is about the time when you're starting to make amends and whatnot. And on page 83 are the 9th step promises. And I'll tell you a quick story about this. When I was in rehab, and I was going through DTs, and the ladies in the group had given me the big book, and I didn't know anything about the book. You know, it was all put together. It wasn't even opened yet. And I remember cracking it open, and I got to page 83, and they start talking about, and I was like, wow, this sounds so great. And I didn't know it at the time, but this is what I was reading. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. And we read that this morning. We just read that this morning. And what I was reading were the 9th step promises. My brother died of alcoholism in 2011. He called me one day, and he said, I was about 2 months sober, and he said, he's like, I'll tell you something. My brother had kind of estranged himself from the family, but out of the blue, he calls me from Connecticut. He goes, Denise, I've got to tell you something, because I'm sick. He goes, I think I'm an alcoholic. Mike was an alcoholic when he was probably 13 years old. Okay, this is the God thing. And I said, Mike, I said, geez. I said, well, I got to tell you something. I said, July 9, I went into Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, I'm sober today. He goes, you? He never knew. That's how much I hid it, my drinking. The family never knew I was that bad off. And he said, can you help me? Yeah, I can. And I went to, I remember talking to my home group, and they said, this is what you do. You don't tell him he has to do anything. You just be there for him. And I sent him some books. I keep them in my bag. And Mike's not here to use those books. He tried AA, but he couldn't get it. And so I'm up here for him. It's because of him that I'm here today. And he didn't die in vain. But the what I went through and trying to tell him that Mike, it's okay, it's all right, you'll be all right. He never mind the 100 forms of fear, he had 1,000, and he couldn't get over it. It was too late for him. And so I went up and saw him a few times, and I remember at the beginning, if you remember, I said something about an alcoholic death. Well, I saw an alcoholic death, and I don't wish that for anybody. He was starting to curl up. You know, he was jaundiced. He was in hospice at this point, and he was starting to curl up. Stomachs extended. I never knew what that was until it was like, be careful what you wish for. And I know that was a God thing saying, this was not for you. You're not meant to do this. You're meant to go out there and help other people, because every problem I have in my life today, there's a solution in this book. This is what Big Book Jim always tells me. There's the solutions in this book. You have to work it. And it's the action. It's the action. And please, if you're coming in and you're new, we joked about the fourth step, and I was being facetious. It's just a deep cleaning of your of to keep going on with this program. Another thing too, and I'm going to tell you, if you're new, please, you're welcomed, and please talk to anybody in these rooms if you're feeling just out of sorts. We've all been there, and this is what I like to tell my sponsees, especially when they start getting to the fourth step. Don't stop walking through the fire. Come through the fire. Keep walking. Come here. We are here for you. Come on. Keep walking. Because if you stop, you're going to get burned. You're going to get burned again. To me, that's a slip. That means to go out again. I can't afford it. And there's just too much joy in my life today for it. Even when my days are shitty, they're great. I mean, so with that, I'm going to end this. And I'd like to just say, I'm also a yoga teacher. I'm a yoga therapist, actually. And how I like to start to end my classes is we say namaste, which is it's basically a God bless you, God go with you. But what it means is the light within me salutes the light within you. The divinity within me salutes the divinity within you. And I've got a light. I want you all to see that light because I want to see yours too. You know, I can help. I can help with this and get your light to shine just as bright as mine, even when my light is not, you know, it's dim or something. I know enough to come in these rooms and talk to you all. So with that, God bless. Thank you.